all that's holy, if it isn't Mr. Trent.
What?
Good day to you, sir.
Mr. Bunner.
Yes, sir. Calvin C. Bunner at your service.
What are you doing in Paris?
Well, sir, I am now resident here as the chief continental agent of the Madison Company, and fully satisfied with that position and its prospects. I may add that life is a great deal quieter now I'm no longer at Madison's beck and call 24 hours a day. No disrespect to the deceased intended. And what brings you to Paris, Mr. Trent?
I'm working for the Record full-time these days. I don't seem able to paint. I've not been in England for a year, as a matter of fact. I have quite lost touch.
Is it a year since the murder? My, my.
Tell me, whatever became of Manderson's other secretary, John Marlowe?
Oh, I can bring you right up to date with John. We're in constant contact, and we're even planning a holiday together this summer. That's if he can tear himself away from his fiancée.
He's engaged to be married?
That's right. A lovely girl. Irish. She'll make him a wonderful wife. John's running his father's business these days and really putting it on the map. He has a fine head on his shoulders, and when he's gotten himself more experience, he'll be up there with the smartest in the land. Mr. Trent, you still with me?
I'm sorry. I thought...
You thought what?
No matter. Mr. Bunner.
Yeah?
What news of Mrs. Manderson?
Oh, can't help you much there, I'm afraid. She left England immediately after the settlement of her husband's affairs, and I believe she lived for some time in Florence, Italy.
Is she still there, do you know?
No, I believe she returned to London, sold up the house in Mayfair, and bought a smaller one out Hampstead way, where she lives quietly alone, hardly venturing into society. Seems a crime, doesn't it? All those good hard dollars just waiting for someone to spraddle them around.
So she was a beneficiary under Manderson's will?
Oh, I'll say. He left her more than half his wad. Why, she has money to burn. Just think of the fear she might make in the world. But nothing doing. Do you know, Mr. Trent, she is the best woman I ever met. But she just could never seem to get the habit of spending money. Mr. Trent, are you still with me?
Forgive me. I can already see the white cliffs above Dover.
You're returning to London?
At once. Thank you, Mr. Bunner.
What for?
Everything.
Yes, yes, I'm coming. Burton Couples?
Hello, Couples. It's Philip Trent.
My dear boy, where are you speaking from?
I'm back in London.
Welcome home.
Couples, I need to speak to your niece.
Aha.
I think we should meet in private and alone.
Oh, do you not?
I realize it's presumption on my part approaching you after what I said about Mabel in my letter. You'd be fully entitled to refuse me, but it is desperately important to me, and we've been friends for a long time.
There's no need to be abject, dear boy. I'll get her to invite you to tea.
Mrs. Manderson, may I say something?
Please do.
It is about what occurred at our last meeting. Do you remember?
I shall never forget.
Well, I owe you an apology. I realize now that what I thought about you was not true.
No.
And I cannot imagine how such suspicions could ever have entered my head.
There's no need to apologize. You were right up to a point.
How?
I can see now that my late husband's actions that night, his attitude towards me during the last few months of his life, were prompted by jealousy towards John Marlowe, as you suspected.
But quite without reason.
I've thought about it a great deal. And all I can think of are little things. For instance, one day he asked me what I most liked about Mr. Marlowe, and I said, his manners. And he gave me a black look and said, yes, Marlowe is a gentleman, not looking at me. Then a while later, Mr. Marlowe fell in love with Alice, an American girl who was the most unprincipled flirt I ever knew. She made a complete fool of him. So, one day, I asked him to row me in a boat on the lake. And in the boat, I told him the truth about Alice. He took it admirably, but didn't believe me a bit. Anyway, when we got back, my husband helped me out of the boat, and though he joked at the time, he was reserved and silent that evening. And he looked so wretched the next day at breakfast that I thought he was ill. Soon after, Mr. Marlowe showed me a note that he'd received from Alice, asking him for his congratulations on her engagement. He was deeply upset. I put my hand on his arm just as my husband came into the room. He looked at us and turned and walked quietly back into his study. He then went away for a week on business, and When he returned, he was looking white and strange, and as soon as he saw me, he asked where Mr. Marlowe was. I should have realized the truth then, but I didn't.
And that is all there was between you?
Yes. Mr. Marlowe's a little younger than I am, and for all his cleverness, I looked on him practically as a boy. He was so vulnerable, so amiable, so lacking in ambition. I felt protective towards him, as one might towards a younger brother. And that, at last, is the whole truth.
You see before you a man dressed in the scrubbiest sackcloth made and daubed with the grittiest ashes. But I do have one more question.
Ask it, by all means.
You have my manuscript incriminating Mr. Marlowe. Why have you never used it?
Because I know he's innocent.
Innocent? But all the evidence...
Evidence of what? He impersonated my husband that night. Escaped by my bedroom window and thereby established an alibi. I don't see those things can be doubted, but that's all. I knew Mr. Marlowe constantly for several years, and I know him to be incapable of a crime of bloodshed. He hated physical violence. It would be impossible for him deliberately to take another man's life.
It is still conceivable he killed by accident or in self-defense.
Yes. I've thought it over till my head ached and I can see no solution to the mystery. All I am clear about is that John Marlowe isn't a murderer. And that if it ever came to court, the judge and jury would probably think he was. So I've simply let it alone.
There's only one thing for it. I must see Marlowe. Do you know where I might find him?
No. But I dare say Uncle Burton could tell you. He met Mr. Marlowe a while ago in London and they talked. Personally, I never saw him again after you left White Gables. Though I'm sure you'll have assumed otherwise. What did you suppose had happened to Mr. Marlowe after you had withdrawn from the scene?
I supposed that you would have married him and gone to live abroad.
In genteel poverty?
I beg your pardon?
Mr. Marlowe had no money then. And under the terms of the will, if I marry again, I lose everything my husband left me.
I had no idea.
On the whole, I'm glad of it. For one thing, it spared me from a good many attentions of a kind a woman in my position frequently has to put up with.
And the other kind?
Ah, trouble me even less. I haven't yet met a man silly enough to want to marry a widow with luxurious habits and tastes and very little money.
Haven't you, by heaven? Then I'm going to show you that human passion is not always stifled by the smell of money. I am not afraid to make a fool of myself. Look at me. It is the sight of the century. It is one who says he loves you and would ask you to give up very great wealth to stand at his side. You have never been out of my thoughts since the time I first saw you. It was only your beauty that filled my mind then, but later I came to know your stronger magic, and it has been with me ever since.
Oh, Mr. Trent, please stop. Where is your self-restraint?
Gone. It has got right away. I am going after it in a minute. I don't care so much now. I love you, honor you, hold you dearest of all the world. There. I have finished. Now you give me leave to go.
No, Philip. I very much want you to stay.
How do you suppose he'll receive us?
Well, Couples, that rather depends.
You still think he's guilty, don't you? I'm sure he isn't.
And so is Mabel.
He had no motive, did he? It was all in Manderson's mind.
He still has a number of questions to answer.
Mr. Trent, Mr. Couples.
Good evening, Mr. Marlowe.
Please come through, both of you.
Please make yourselves comfortable.
Thank you,
Mr. Marlowe.
Are you here as a witness, Mr. Couples, or merely moral support?
As an interested party, Mr. Marlowe, nothing more.
You've read Mr. Trent's manuscript.
Yes, I'm aware of its contents.
Mr. Couples and I discussed the matter fully before I left Marlstone.
I've read it three times. It's an astonishing document, Mr. Trent. You've got at so much of the truth.
Thank you. There are still some pieces missing, which we are looking to you to provide.
In my own defense?
Listen, I still have no reason to doubt the conclusions I came to regarding the events of that night and your involvement in them. You wore Manderson's shoes, you impersonated his voice, you made your escape through the window of Mrs. Manderson's bedroom, all in a determined attempt to establish an alibi. Why?
Let me tell you the facts of what happened that night. Bunner and I dined with the Mandersons, rising from the table at about 9. Then Mrs. Manderson retired to the drawing room. Bunner went to visit a friend, and Manderson led me to the orchard behind the house, saying he wished to have a talk. He said there was a big thing on, and he wanted me to do him an important service.
Please continue.
Manderson asked me if I remembered the name George Harris. Yes, I said. On your instructions, I booked a cabin in that name on the boat that leaves Southampton at noon tomorrow. Whereupon he took the ticket from his wallet, handed it to me, and said, George Harris cannot leave England tomorrow. You must go in his place. I'm here to obey orders, I said. Yes, he said, but these aren't ordinary orders.
Mm-hmm.
The point is this. The deal I'm busy with will be ruined if anybody's aware of my involvement. So if my secretary is known to have crossed to Paris at this time, the game is up. Rather grudgingly, I agreed to do my best to conceal my identity. He then gave me a list of complicated instructions. What they amounted to was this. I was to take the car and set off for Southampton immediately, since no train would fit in. Once in Southampton, at about 6 the following morning, I was to proceed to the Bedford Hotel and inform Harris, if he was there, that I was to go to Paris in his stead.
And if he wasn't?
Well, that meant that he'd received Manderson's telegram and the plan would proceed without him. I was to leave the car at a garage under an assumed name, change my appearance, and travel by the boat as George Harris. In Paris, I was to take a room at the Hotel St. Petersburg, where I would, in the course of time, receive a message addressed to George Harris, instructing me where to take a locked wallet which Manderson was going to give me.
And all this in the strictest secrecy?
Absolutely. Anyway, I threw a few necessaries into a suitcase and rejoined him in the library, where he handed me a stout leather letter case, about 8 inches by 6, fastened with a strap and with a lock on it. It just fitted into my side pocket. I was about to leave when I realized I only had a few shillings in my pocket. I suppose I should explain. I'd been keeping myself short of cash because, well, I'd been speculating, particularly on Wall Street, and, as Bunner put it, I'd been separated from my role.
You'd lost all your money?
The lot. And on that fatal Sunday night, Manderson knew that I was perfectly penniless. You should bear that fact in mind. Anyway, back to the story. I went to Manderson and asked for expenses for the journey. Immediately his hand went towards his hip pocket, where he usually kept a little case containing about £100. Then suddenly he checked and swore under his breath. I assumed that he'd mislaid his note case and reminded him that he had in his desk £1,000 in small notes, which I'd drawn for him. I suggested he should take my expenses out of that.
Yes.
He looked at me with such fury on his face, such hatred in his eyes. Then he said he'd get some money and I was to wait in the car. My mind was in turmoil. I'd never seen him behave like that before, though Bunner had told me of his sudden outbursts when they were alone.
So what did you do?
I stepped out onto the lawn and paced up and down, smoking a cigarette. Presently I passed close to one of the drawing-room windows and I noticed Mrs. Manderson's shadow on the thin silk curtain. Well, the window was open, and I heard her asking Manderson if £30 would be enough. He said it would do, and I heard the chink of money. Then he said, and I remember his words exactly, he said, I'm going out now. Marlowe has persuaded me to go for a moonlight run in the car. He says it'll help me sleep.
Your errand was secret. He told a little lie.
But Manderson never lied, even on the most insignificant matter. And yet what had I just heard? A voluntary statement that was totally false. I was suddenly on my guard. My mind was racing. Why did he tell that lie? What had he done with the money? Why wasn't it in his desk? Gentlemen, I believe that lie saved me from being hanged as his murderer.
Continue, please.
I stepped quickly to the car, where Manderson handed me a little under £30. He got in, and we drove off towards Bishopsbridge. At the gate to the golf course, a mile or so from the house, he said he would get out. I stopped the car. He asked me to repeat the instructions he'd given me. I did so. He said, goodbye then, and stay with that wallet. I drove off, looking in the mirror as I did so. In it, for a moment, I saw Manderson's face, clear in the moonlight. It was the face of a triumphant madman. It was suddenly clear to me that he hated me insanely and was gloating over me, driving away to my fate.
And to what did you attribute this sudden hatred?
I've no idea. I still haven't. Who can plumb the depths of a madman's delusion?
You are convinced he was insane?
Oh, Mr. Trent, what sane man takes his own life to deliver someone he hates to the hangman?
You are saying that Manderson was responsible for his own death?
I am.
But there were no powder burns. And why
Suppose we have the story first, my dear chap, and discuss the details later.
Yes, of course. Of course, forgive me. Mr. Marlowe, please proceed.
There's a sharp bend in the road about 300 yards from where I set Manderson down, and once I was out of his sight, I stopped the car and got out. I suddenly knew where the money was, £1,000. It was in my pocket. The whole Paris business was a blind.
Yes! of course, I see.
Manderson would return to the house, phone the police, and tell them I'd taken his car and some money and was attempting to escape the country. They'd catch up with me in Paris if I got that far.
Living under a false name.
Wearing a disguise.
Having garaged the car under a false name.
And having travelled on the ferry in a cab in which I had booked in advance also under a false name.
The crime of a man who was desperately short of money.
And I was desperately short of money, and Manderson knew it.
Ingenious.
I took the letter case from my pocket, tore the staple out of the lock, and examined the contents in the headlights of the car.
Yes, Manderson's note case, £1,000, and two small wash leather bags containing uncut diamonds.
Exactly.
Good grief.
I knew instantly what I had to do. I turned the car, intending to catch up with Manderson before he reached the house and to tell him to his face what I thought of him. I was already travelling fast towards White Gables when I heard a shot in front of me and to the right. My first wild thought was that Manderson was shooting at me, and then I realised that the noise hadn't been close at hand, and I could see nobody in spite of the bright moonlight. As I reached the gate where I'd set Manderson down, I saw him. He was lying dead on the turf, clearly visible, just inside the gate.
On the golf course?
Obviously. The eighth green is just there.
Yes, he was on the green. Quite close to the flag, his arms stretched out, and his eye. Well, you know, you saw it.
Yes.
Close by lay his soft black hat, and at his feet was what I soon identified as my revolver. For a few seconds, I sat there helplessly staring at the body. Then I realized the appalling danger I was in. It wasn't prison Manderson had planned for me, but the scaffold.
Yes.
Do you play chess, Mr. Trent?
Yes, I do. Why?
I've played since I was a boy, and I'm pretty good. Manderson and I would play most evenings. He was brilliant. He planned his financial coups rather like a chess game and was a master of the unexpected. It occurred to me that he must have planned his death like a chess game too, and that I must now do likewise if I wanted to get out of my predicament with a whole skin. And gradually the whole strange plan fell into place.
Were you so confident that you could imitate Manderson's voice?
Oh, I'd done it before and fooled Banner.
It took great courage all the same.
I just needed to remain calm.
So you loaded the body into the car, drove back to White Gables and deposited him by the shed.
That's right. Then I put on his hat and outer garments.
Including the shoes.
Yes. They were painful all the time I wore them, but I knew that no footstep of mine must appear on the soft ground between the hut and the house. Mm. So I crammed my feet into them and just got on with the job. The rest, I think, you know.
It must have been a horrible business, dressing and undressing the body.
Yes. The worst part was getting his teeth out. But I was wriggling my head out of a noose. I knew it had to be done. Unfortunately, in my hurry, it seems I forgot to pull down his cuffs and put his watch in the wrong pocket, but I needed to get away if I was to be in Southampton by 6. And it was on that that my alibi depended.
I think the occasional mistake is understandable given the circumstances. You'd drunk a fair amount of whiskey, too.
Oh, no, you're wrong about that. I'd had one stiff one, that's all. I poured the rest into a flask for the journey.
Ah.
I knew how important it was that I kept a clear head. There were so many things to do.
Indeed, you needed to clean the revolver and return it to your own room.
Replace the money and the diamonds in the desk.
Take off the shoes and place them outside Manderson's bedroom door.
Select a suit, tie and shoes for the body. Put his teeth in the bowl.
Leaving fingerprints as you did so.
Yes, yes.
Tumble the bed and make it look as if it had been slept in. And all this with Mrs. Manderson in the adjoining room.
Your worst moment must surely have been when she spoke.
Oh, yes, indeed. I knew it was a possibility, but I nearly lost my nerve all the same.
What I don't understand is why you needed to leave the house by way of her window. There were other rooms which were empty on that side of the house where there was little chance of being seen by Martin or by anybody else.
Oh, I hadn't the nerve. When I entered Manderson's room, I seemed to shut the door on half my terrors.
But what if Mrs. Manderson had remained awake?
I hoped and prayed she wouldn't. I knew her to be a sound sleeper. It seemed a reasonable risk to take. And I hadn't anticipated at that point that by using her window I would be laying her open to the charge of complicity in Manderson's murder. I'd have done anything rather than that. Well, gentlemen, that's my story.
Well, Trent, are you satisfied?
Fully.
Well, let's go then. We've taken up enough of Mr. Marlowe's time. Goodbye, Marlowe.
Mr. Cupples.
For my part, I never thought you guilty for a moment.
Oh, thank you.
Goodbye, Marlowe. Oh, one last question.
Yes?
Suppose someone else had been put on trial for the murder?
I'd have taken my story to the lawyers for the defense and put myself in their hands.
Well, there's no chance of that now, I think. I was talking to Inspector Mertz at Scotland Yard this morning. There isn't a shred of evidence against anyone. The official view is that it was a case of revenge by some American Black Hand gang. So, that is the end of that. Mr. Marlowe, I am a man who has worked hard to put a rope around your neck. Will you shake hands? Thank you. Come along, Cupples. You are dining with me.
This is all very luxurious, Trent.
I come here only on special occasions. They do a saddle of mutton that's beyond compare.
Oh. And what are we celebrating this evening? The satisfactory conclusion to the Manderson affair?
No. No. This evening we are celebrating the fact that Mabel and I are to be married.
Oh, my dear friend. That is excellent news. Oh, I congratulate you from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you.
May I say how earnestly I've hoped for this ever since receiving your letter. Mabel has seen so much unhappiness, but, oh, she'll make you a simply glorious wife.
I am sure of it. Now, what are we to drink? The wine here?
No, I think I'll have a milk and soda water.
What? A couple's not so loud. The waiter has a weak heart.
However, you order the wine by all means to mark the occasion, and I'll have a sip of yours.
As you wish. As you wish. Well, my dear friend, it's been an extraordinary case.
Yes, indeed.
Though one small detail of it still puzzles me.
What's that?
The marks on Manderson's wrists. I imagine he did it himself to suggest...
No. No, Trent. They happened in the struggle.
Struggle? What struggle?
When I was trying to wrest the gun from his hand.
You?
Yes. I shot Sigsbee Manderson.
What?
It wasn't murder. On that night, I was taking my bedtime constitutional at about 10:15. I was nearly opposite the gate by the 8th hole on the golf course on the field path that runs behind White Gables when I heard a car coming. Then I heard it stop. I saw Manderson get out.
Yes?
As the car drove off again, to my great amazement, I saw him violently shake his fist at it. Then he went through the gate to the golf course and stood quite still on the 8th green. For a few moments he stood there with his head bent. Then his hand went to the pocket of his overcoat and he took out a revolver, which he held to his chest. I saw his face in the moonlight, and I knew at once he was insane.
You think he intended suicide?
Well, that's what I thought at the time. Perhaps he was only planning to wound himself. I don't know. Anyway, almost before I knew what I was doing, I leapt out of the shadows and seized his arm. He threw me off and pointed the gun at my head.
Good heavens.
And I managed to seize his wrist and hung on, fighting for my life. Somehow I tore the gun from his fingers. I never dreamt I had so much strength. And I retreated a few steps. And he sprang for my throat. I fired blindly in his face. His knees gave way and he fell in a heap on the turf. I flung the revolver down and bent over him. He was already dead. It was then that I heard the car returning. I hid.
You saw John Marlowe get out?
The whole time he was pacing up and down the green, I was within a few yards of him. I dare not show myself. I quarreled with Manderson that morning, in public, in front of the hotel. I was bound to be suspected. Assuming that Marlowe would immediately call for the police and that they would think it a case of suicide, I dashed back to the hotel, climbed in through a rear window, and I ordered myself a cup of cocoa.
Oh, my dear old friend. Why on earth didn't you tell me this before?
Well, I would have. I was on the point of doing so when you told me you suspected Marlowe. But
what?
Your case against him had been put together so ingeniously, I simply didn't have the heart. I resolved to make a clean breast of it in the following morning, but by then, you'd gone. Your letter clearly stated that you intended to take no further action in the case, so I let sleeping dogs lie. However, you do have my abject apologies and my assurance that if Marlowe had had to face charges, I'd have come forward straight away.
Oh, Couples. I am cured. You've beaten me. I shall never touch a crime mystery again. The Manderson affair will be Philip Trent's last case.
Oh, there's just one thing I insist on.
What's that?
You shall pay for dinner.
In Trent's Last Case by E.C. Bentley, the cast was Philip Trent, Martin Jarvis. Mabel Manderson, Helena Breck. Marlowe, Simon Hewitt. Bunner, Brian Hewlett. And Couples, Manning Wilson. Inspector Murch, Alan Downer. Martin, Stephen Thorne. Sir James Molloy, Sean Barrett. And Mrs. Morgan, Joanna Wake. Figgis, Paul Gregory. Edison, David Goodland. Williams, Stuart Organ, Abbott, Simon Cuff, and Dr. Stock, Stephen Hattersley. Other parts are played by members of the cast. Trent's Last Case was dramatized for radio by Alan Downer and directed by Jerry Jones.